Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Thinking big thoughts so you don't have to.
That,
here's John Williams,
is a good idea. Mm-mm. We should have a Let's Go Swim with John Day.
How about that? Let's do it.
And you know, it's one of these things. We'll have lifeguards and rowboats, and we'll have people with ambulances standing by. And I'm thinking cocktails. Maybe after, but...
Can't think of anything better.
I don't... Maybe that's a dangerous combination, but really it's the order in which you enjoy them.
So absolutely.
We do a thing like, hey, I'm John. This would be me on the radio. And then I'd say, we're going to be at Ohio Street Beach right over here or something like that. And we'll all go for a swim and then we'll come back and then we'll have cocktails. Okay, I'm a little thin on the details right now. I'm not exactly sure if this is such a good idea.
Well, we need to cook out.
I know, that's what I'm thinking. This is really, I'm describing a cookout.
Right.
But I don't know what swimmers do. I don't know how this would work.
John, well, we could give out WGN beach towels.
Yes! What's the matter, Elif?
Wasn't there a crown cam on this?
There was a crown cam from a previous episode where I went to the beach on opening day. And there's nobody there. They say the beaches are now open. They always make a big announcement about it. So there I was with my crown on, camera attached, in my swimsuit. And there was just me and some birds. There was no... And the water, of course, was freezing. It was like, you know, the last day of May. But now is when we should do a trip to the beach with John.
Yeah.
A little beach party.
Summer is really underway.
A beach party. We'll play Beach Boys music. We'll wear silly...
We'll have beach balls.
Yes!
There okay. We go. Now it's a party.
Now we need a beach. And, you know, appropriate activities.
Well, a little beach volleyball.
Totally that. 312-981-7200. Text your swell ideas for Kim Gordon and John Williams' beach party bingo.
Oh, we could have human bingo on the beach.
Yeah?
How would we do that?
Human. Yeah. Maybe I thought you were describing something I didn't know about. You're describing
something. I'm making it up as I go.
You don't know about. I want to spend some time at least making sure I understand this Donald Trump Jr. series of tweets, which are related to the series of email. So in his latest tweet, the president's son said, and you've probably heard or read, to everyone, in order to be totally transparent, I'm releasing the entire email chain of my emails with Rob Goldstone. The first email was June 3rd, 2016. The information they suggested they had about Hillary Clinton I thought was political opposition research. I decided to take the meeting. The woman who met with them said she had no information to provide and wanted to talk about adoption policy and the Magnitsky Act. To put this in context, this occurred before the current Russian fever was in vogue. So there's essentially him sort of prefacing his email dump. But the dump is amazing to me because it says here, this is the one, June 3rd, 2016. And Rob Goldstone writes this email to Donald Trump Jr. Good morning. Emin just called and asked me to contact you with something very interesting. The Crown Prosecutor of Russia met with his father, Aris, this morning, and in their meeting offered to provide the Trump campaign with some official documents and information that would incriminate Hillary and her dealings with Russia and would be very useful to your father. This is obviously very high-level and sensitive information, but is part of Russia and its government support for Mr. Trump, helped along by Aris and Emin. What do you think is the best way to handle this information, and would you be able to speak to Emin about it directly? I can also send this information to your father via Rona, but it is ultra-sensitive, so wanted to send to you first. Best, Rob Goldstone. And the president's son that day responded, He responded 17 minutes later, "Thanks, Rob. I appreciate that. If it is what you say, I love it, especially later in the summer. Could we do a call first thing next week when I'm back? Best, Don." And the president's son released that today. Now, you may applaud him for his transparency, but I'm rather surprised that he thinks it's wise to, A, do that, and B, admit that.
Well, wait a minute. He did it minutes ahead of the New York Times releasing it. That's why, I mean, I think that's...
He thinks he's getting in front of it.
A little bit, yeah.
With this explanation.
The New York Times, one of the editors, tweeted that not long after it was released that they were about to.
Okay, but can I just... So here's, to me, the hell of a thing. This is obviously very high-level and sensitive information, but is part of Russia and its government's support for Mr. Trump, helped along by Aris and Emin. So Rob Goldstone is telling Donald Trump Jr., here is help as part of Russia and its government's support for Mr. Trump. Isn't that what we've been trying to uncover for the last, I don't know, several months? Now, this isn't conclusive or definitive, but... And by the way, there was no cookies in the jar. But this is somebody reaching out to the campaign and the president's son saying, I'll take that meeting. What if there was sensitive information or incriminating information? This is him saying he was part and parcel of that. I know you know that, but I mean, what did he think the upside was? Okay, right, the New York Times is going to get in front of it anyway, so he might as well go first.
We don't know if there are cookies in the jar right now, right?
I'm assuming there weren't.
Okay.
Well, I mean, didn't he say all they wanted to talk about was the Magnitsky Act and adoption policy? They didn't have any goods. It was all gibberish.
That is what he said. Well, I mean, that is what he said.
Sure, it is.
And NBC talked to the woman, the lawyer, Russian, and it was her account. And, you know, again, she is a Russian agent by most accounts, so I don't know how much stock you give her either, but... You know, she said that they were desperate for the information, that they had reached out to her.
Who's
that?
That
doesn't...
Oh, the Trump,
people. Or maybe Goldstone on behalf of the Trumps, I don't know. That doesn't seem to fit with that email chain.
It's a sad day when you don't know who to believe, when there's two sides of a story, when our president and the president of Russia sit down and both come out with a different version about how they talked about the election hack, for instance. You don't know who to trust. In this case, this... You know, oddball attorney who has connections to the Kremlin from Russia. Do you believe her or do you believe the president's son? I'm not inclined to believe either. So you really don't know which way to go. Of course, your inclination is to believe the United States and its version of events. But this administration and this family's given you no reason to really do that. And the Russians are no friends of ours. So why in the world would you believe them? Maybe they are telling the truth. Maybe it does seem credible, but you can't trust them any more than you can trust us.
It would be the first time.
What's that?
If they were telling the truth.
Okay, but really, the president lies every day. So what you got to go on? And so then he says, in order to be totally transparent, I'm releasing this entire chain. This is before the Russian fever was in vogue. And as he said in the press, it was the most inane nonsense I ever heard. I was actually agitated by it, says Goldstone. But I'm sorry, guys, I don't think that's a compelling defense. I pulled the trigger, no bullet came out. I went to the bank, no money was there. I reached into the pot, there were no cookies. I took the meeting with incriminating information about the Clintons, and it was nonsense. I'm not sure that really is a great defense. If it's all you got, go with it, but... I don't think you got a lot there. He writes back, thanks, I appreciate it. If it's what you say, I love it. How did the New York Times get this email chain?
Not just I love it, but already plotting, we'll use it later in the summer.
Yeah, we could use it especially later in the summer, meaning this is June of 2016, so August would maybe be more beneficial, closer to November, obviously.
Right.
Closer to the, and by the way, the president's son is writing back, not yet knowing what Billy Bush tapes are going to reveal. So, yeah, if there were some goods there, they might have played that ace up their sleeve, but they didn't have it. This has just been handed to me. Is this about this, what we're talking about? You can text to 312-981-7200. We do have working phone lines as well. If he does get charged and convicted, who cares? His dad can pardon him anyway. Boy, that'd be a twist. Oh, that would just be the last chapter. John, I'll bet Obama Hillary asked Goldstone to play this game and remember this text in 2 to 3 months when this comes out. Okay, I will. I will remember this if we find out that the Clintons and Obamas orchestrated this. Don't you get the feeling that if an asteroid was coming to Earth just before it hit us and wiped out all of humanity, somebody would say, you know, this is Obama's fault. Thanks a lot, Obama. Thanks a lot, Obama. John, I find the entire Trump administration to be inherently transparent, signed Sue. Thank you, Sue. I'm not exactly sure what you mean by that, though. I mean, in this case, yeah, maybe their motives are clear. I'm just amazed that they're that dumb. Don't take the meeting. Doesn't this sound like a trap anyway? I mean, literally, if Donald had gotten the following email, I wonder what his response would be. Dear Mr. Trump Jr., I am the exiled cousin of the crown prince of a wealthy African nation. My assets are tied up in a Swiss bank account by a corrupt government. Please give me your credit card number so that we can wire the funds to you. I mean, isn't this kind of the same thing? You go, yeah, I don't think we're going to do that. But it's so tempting because in June of 2016, we didn't know what was going to happen. They didn't know they were going to win the election. And so if somebody says, I've got the goods for you, Hillary and the Russians, wow.
Well, remember, it wasn't a cold call. I mean, this Goldstone was known to them, worked with them on the Miss Universe pageant in Moscow.
Yeah.
So, you know, they knew. I'd be sort of like when I offer to give you incriminating stuff. You know who I am. You know how reliable it is.
Well, who is it that we spoke to about this yesterday, Steve? And he said, oh, I know it was the legal reporter, the legal affairs reporter for the New York Times. And I said, just ask yourself what Hillary Clinton or Bill Clinton would have done if this information had fallen in their lap in reverse. How would they have behaved? You and I don't know, but I've got a guess. He said, well, we don't know. It's a good point. But remember, Al Gore was given something just like this when he was running against George Bush. And not just like this, but he was given sensitive information.
He was given the debate books.
Yes, he was given the debate books. And what did he do? He turned them over to the FBI.
I'd forgotten about that until he brought that up.
And I only vaguely remember that. I presume they did not pre-read them.
Oh, no, they read them. they came and it was, I think it was a day or two before the debate.
Yeah.
And then they said that they'd called the FBI and given them to the FBI.
What a nice lesson learned. And as you know, Gore then won the election and became the president. So
he's been rewarded for his good deeds.
The high road is always the best way to go. Okay, 312-981-7200. Give me your thoughts and reactions to this story, please. I'd like to hear from you next on WGN. And so on the Who Goes to Jail First horse race, remember, the three horses have all along been Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump, and now Donald Trump Jr. It was Hillary in the lead, but here comes Donald Trump. And now it's Donald Trump Jr. on the outside as they round the far turn. It's Jr. We'll keep you posted. We'll keep you posted. I don't think you're supposed to do that. Anytime you get a Russian attorney named Natalia Velenskinaya.
Darling.
It's so Boris and Natasha. She says, denied in an interview with NBC having ever acted on behalf of the Russian government. Well, then, she's not going to lie. Because that would be unethical. So here's what happened to a friend of mine. He's downtown with some friends, and they're enjoying a wine on the new Riverwalk. At the wine place. What's it called?
City Winery?
City Winery. So they're having some wine at City Winery. And then they got up and thought, we'd better Uber home. But they live in the suburbs. So like out by LaGrange, where I used to live. So they just Uber. They get in an Uber. You know, you type in, hey, we're going to LaGrange from downtown. A car pulls up. And as he's dropping them off, 1, 2, 3, 4, he turns to the last two in the car after having let off two. And he says, hey, listen. I'm going to have to deadhead all the way back to the city. I'm not picking up any rides. What are you guys going to do for me? It's sort of like the delivery man story I had for you yesterday.
You sure this isn't a story about you?
Well, in fact, it is. I started to tell my friend the story, and he goes, no, I got a better one. So the Uber guy turns around and says, what do you got for me? And I said, is this the same guy that delivered my ping pong table? Excuse me, my indoor-outdoor table tennis facility? And he said, so we're sitting there, and we go, well, yeah, that kind of sucks for you. And they gave him some extra cash for the trip back.
Wow.
I wouldn't have done that. I think that's part of the algorithm.
Of course it is. You don't owe them.
I'm amazed. And my friend is the kind of guy who would double down opposite. I'm shocked that he said, yeah, too bad for you. Here's 20
bucks. What if he had taken a flash cab to LaGrange? You know, the cabbie wouldn't have turned and said, hey, I'm not going to get a ride back into the city.
Well, when you do take a cab, they charge you time and a half if it's out of a zone, right? So if you get in a cab, for instance, at O'Hara and Midway, I've done this 1,000 times. This doesn't happen to you, Steve? If I would go to LaGrange, he'd say, since you're out of the immediate perimeter, it's going to cost me extra to drive back. I'm not going to pick up a ride. You owe me extra for the, there's an extra charge they
But
charge.
That's set when you get in the
Absolutely
cab.
Absolutely it is. I get it.
And I'm assuming that Uber has different pricing as well for distance. Or...
Sure. And if they don't, that's on them. But you don't make it up as you go.
No.
I can't see the cabbie at the end of the ride going, you know, it sucks to be me. Right. So how about you just give me some, no, that's not, I'll tip you. I mean, I get that, blah, 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 but I don't owe you 20 bucks, dude.
Of course, they're getting out at their house, right? So the man
right.
Uber driver knows where they live.
Yeah. Well, that's it. Does an Uber driver have the right to not even take that fare?
Yeah.
So, and you know where you're going. So I don't know if he thought he had him when he gets out there. Like, okay, now I'll just hit them with this and play the sympathy card.
Because I'm sure you got a big payoff to go out there. Well, you know, I don't take a lot of Ubers.
I do.
The last time I did, I took it to Ravinia from my house, and the woman was from Maywood, the driver.
Yeah.
And same thing, though. She had taken someone from the city, I think, up to the suburbs.
Right.
And then just responded to the call. She was now working my hood.
Yeah, that's the way I feel about it. By the way, there's need for Uber in LaGrange and Hinsdale and Western Springs and Brookfield. Less than downtown Chicago, but that's on you, Uber driver. If you've had an experience like this, I want to hear about it a little later in the show. You can text to me now, 312-981-7200. Tomorrow's going to be an interesting day. 70,000 websites, big and small. You'll click on them, and they'll all have some message that will take a position on net neutrality, and they'll all be for it. But the administration, the FCC, are rolling it back. And so what does that mean, and what does that mean to you? You know who's really for net neutrality? You know who's really upset about this? Pornhub, the people that put pornography on the internet, or at least some of them, because I'm not exactly sure why. But I think if their stuff takes more time to load, or if it's slower, or if they have to pay a higher price to get the sort of fast action you want, and I believe you do, then it'll cost them money, or it'll make it more difficult for them to be competitive. So they're not happy about it. But, you know, it seems like just, in fact, the conversation I had with Maggie Reardon, who we'll talk to in a couple of minutes off the air, I said, I think you need to at least help us understand the conversation for rescinding it, for rolling it back. It seems like everybody is for net neutrality, Maggie. So why are we doing this? In a minute. A moment ago, I told you the story about some friends of mine who took a Uber from downtown Chicago all the way out to the western suburbs. And as they got near their destination, the guy said, you know, I'm not picking up any rides on the way back. What are you going to do for me? Mark wanted to say something about that. Are you an Uber driver, Mark?
Yes, I am, John. How are you doing, Steve?
Hey, good. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Okay, go ahead. A couple of things. First of all, a driver won't know where the person's going until they get in the car and then turn a trip on.
A couple of texters pointed that out to me. I want to make that clear. So an Uber driver, even though you know and it's on the map, I'm not exactly sure why they don't give this information to the Uber driver. Maybe because they won't pick you up. But you don't know until I get in the car.
They don't want the folks to cherry pick, so to speak.
I guess.
But once you get in the car, even though the company frowns on it, there have been situations where drivers have said, you know, listen, I can't go out there. I got to get to work or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
And then at that point, the driver can cancel ride at no charge to the customer. And the customer can call another Uber driver. Maybe the guy might want to get on the phone when he gets selected by an Uber driver, say, do you mind driving out to LaGrange?
Yeah.
And then third of all, to be basically held up like that is completely completely against the rules of the company. The thing that your buddy can do is, I don't know how long ago this was, but you can rate a driver up to 3 days. And when he gets back to where he took that ride and gives a rating, he can actually contact the company through their website, the customer service website, and file a complaint against this driver, because the odds are that they'll knock this driver off the platform. As I was saying to your producer, this is my quote-unquote competition. I don't need it. You know, I don't need any help from anybody else.
Giving bad names to other Uber drivers. Yeah, right.
It's given bad names to other Uber drivers, and you know, that's a ride I could have picked up. I go out to suburbs all the time. It's not a problem with me, and I'm from the city. And another thing is, there's a feature that Uber has put on for the drivers where you can drop somebody off in LaGrange, for example, and set your destination. So back to the city would be what that driver would do. And he would only get rides back to the city.
Going back in that direction. That makes sense.
Going back in that direction, even if it wasn't all the way back to the city, but just in the neighborhood. The odds of that happening are probably maybe 5-10%, but it happens to me on a somewhat regular basis. So anyway, that's my input. And pass it along to your buddy. Contact the company. Contact customer service. Tell them the experience you had. Even if it's been longer than a few days, contact them anyway. And the company will identify the driver. Most likely, he'll get part of his fare back, if not all of it.
Yeah.
And because that's just poor business.
No, you got that right. Hey, Mark, I'm glad you're listening and driving. Thanks for the phone call. Good luck to you on all of that. It's 1:44 on WGN. Maggie Reardon's on the phone line now. We're just talking about her and her article at CNET about this net neutrality thing. Hey, Maggie, it's John Williams. You're on WGN in Chicago. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me on.
So there's going to be a sort of page takeover day, a day of action, they're calling it, tomorrow. And 70,000 websites or so, big and small, everything from Google and Facebook to Snap, Airbnb, Reddit, all the way down to little mom and pop shops, it sound like. All of these websites are going to post on their pages something about net neutrality tomorrow. Why are they doing that?
Well, what they're trying to do is strum up some grassroots support to make the FCC keep its 2015 rules in place. The agency has opened a proceeding to roll back the rules, and they're saying, no, let's keep them. They're popular. We like them. They protect the Internet. Don't do anything to it.
What's happening with net neutrality? What is it, and what direction should we go?
Well, net neutrality is the idea that your broadband provider or wireless company shouldn't be able to slow down or block traffic or your access to any particular site or service, and they shouldn't be able to charge companies an extra fee to get to their customers faster. And there were some very strict rules that were adopted in 2015, and everybody pretty much agrees that net neutrality is a good idea. It's like saying, you know, I'm in favor of world peace. But I think the details, the devil's in the details. And what the argument here is the legal basis that the FCC used. And that's what the broadband companies don't like. They say that the FCC is applying rules that were made for the old style telephone network and turn broadband into a public utility, and they don't like that. And so that's where the dispute is.
That's funny, because that's kind of where it comes down to me. Is this a private company and they can do whatever they want? They can charge their own rates. They can prefer their own vendors or their own services? Or is it a public utility and they have an obligation to give everybody equal access at the same price? What's the answer to that?
Well, I mean, the FCC in its 2015 order clearly said that this is, that the public should have access to this, that these pipes are, it's like a road. You know, you can't deny access to anybody who's trying to transport commerce on your road. So that's what the FCC has clearly said. Now, the companies say, again, that they support that idea, but they don't want the legal basis to stand. And unfortunately, the courts have already said over and over that, the FCC needs to base its rules on a legal foundation. And, um, and this is the legal foundation that seems to have stuck the most.
Well, okay, but so, I don't. Who are we kidding here? They may say, okay, our quibble is procedural. It's with the legal basis upon which they're doing this, but it's not. They want to favor their own vendors or their own programming, and they want to charge the other guys more for it or give them slower service, right?
Oh, sure. I mean, you're right. They'll say one thing, but if you look at where their businesses are going, you've got companies now like AT&T that brought DirecTV, right? Now that company has TV content, and they're delivering TV service over their connections. Comcast is doing the same thing with NBC Universal. Verizon is trying to get into this business as well, right? So now these guys are not just your broadband and telephone and cable providers, but they're also delivering you content. And so they're competing with companies like Hulu and YouTube and Facebook and all these companies that are also trying to deliver content to you. And I think, you know, what the courts have said and what supporters of net neutrality have pointed out is that when you've got a company that controls that pipe and that access into your home, and they're also selling you services that compete with somebody else who doesn't own that road.
Right.
They do have an incentive to favor their own business over their competitors, and that's where the problem is.
All right. So, last thing, then Maggie, can you give me an example of how this would affect me one way or the other? I mean, what am I enjoying now, or what would I lose if as this rollback goes through?
Well, I think what people need to be aware of is that the changes that are likely to happen would probably, they would happen gradually. And I think what I fear is that in 10 years, you look back and the internet will look like something totally different. It'll look like the cable network today, right? When I sign up for cable, I sign up for packages of channels, and I don't get a choice in what channels those are. Somebody else is deciding for me what I get to view. And, you know, there is a real risk that could happen on the internet, where if you have these companies who are controlling your access to content, they could determine what you see. And maybe it wouldn't be as blatant as selling you a package of internet sites you could go to, but maybe they would be stopping the next YouTube or the next Hulu.
Right, because, sure.
Right.
Sure, because
it's
slower.
Because they would box them out of the market.
What do you think of my theory? And then I'll let you go. But I've long thought this, and you've just made me think about it again, more about subscription services to magazines, newspapers, things that we sort of take for granted these days and are dying on the vine. Newspapers that are having trouble with subscriptions. And yet everybody loves to read them online for free, but nobody wants to pay for it. And I think at some point what we need to come to is something like, whenever I go on the internet, I get charged a fee, a per click, and maybe it would be a hundredth of a penny. It's sort of like what you are talking about now, where access to the internet is going to be cost prohibitive or costly. It's not going to be completely free. But shouldn't we have a system where if you're going to read the New York Times on Twitter, that article, you're not subscribing to the New York Times, but lo and behold, it's there. If you're, you know, and the list goes on. How about if each time I just click on something, it's just a fraction of a penny? But ultimately, those content providers would be compensated by our clicks. If you read it or don't, when you click, you're charged. What do you think of that theory?
Well, in a sense, they already are, right? Because they make their money based on advertising, and that advertising is sold based on clicks. So, even though I am not personally paying for it, there's no like debit card attached to my my internet browser,
right.
But my eyeballs are paying for it, right?
I guess
and
so.
I think that is the business model, and then you've also got some companies that the New York Times does charge for access, and it seems like it's it's pretty effective. If you max out the number of articles that you've clicked on, you know, you have to pay.
Then you have to start to pay, right? They all give you free for a while, and then I think a lot of people opt not to pay when they get to that 10th or the 11th article. And the clicks are when you click on the ads, not when you click on the sites. Am I correct about that? Or do they count?
Not necessarily, huh. No. No, they're counting, like, you know, for example, you know, the company I work for, CNET, you know, I write for a publication that provides free content to people. But, you know, we sell our, you know, we sell to our advertisers, you know, they look at what our traffic is, right? So they can get an idea, just like you do for any other kind of advertising business in the newspaper industry or magazines. You know, you look at your circulation, and then you're able to sell advertising based upon that. And you look at, you know, the demographics of who you are, who's reading your stuff. And really online, you're getting a better picture of who's viewing your content. You know, I mean, the online advertising market is very robust, and you know, that is what's fueling the internet today. You know, will that continue in the future? Will there be other business models? You know, that's yet to be seen. I'm sure someone's got to come up with something, because I think you're right in the sense that as a journalist, it's a little scary that this is how I make my living, and you know, it's a tough business to make money. But as a consumer, I don't think I'd really be in favor of someone attaching a debit card to my
No,
browser.
You're absolutely right. But I think we'd agree that as a consumer, you would also miss CNET and the New York Times if they went away. So I think we need to find a way to help them better monetize the work that people like you do. I'm out of time. Maggie, it's nice to talk to you for free. Let's visit again on the radio sometime soon, okay?
I would love that. Thank you.
Maggie Reardon writes for CNET. The editorial in the Chicago Tribune today remind me of something I heard on the radio the other day after the Cubs game, and that was their last game, the one they lost, what was it, 13-2, gave up 10 in the first inning to the Pirates, the last game before the All-Star break. The fans were booing. Boo. I'm not a big fan of booing your team. I'm okay with booing the refs, booing the other team, booing the coach. But booing your team. And there they were, booing the Cubs. And the Tribune's editorial was interesting. It was like what I heard on the radio over the weekend. But I want to just talk about part of that with you and the Cubs' second half. Or what happened in the first half, for that matter. We'll also visit with Mike Quincy, an automotive specialist for Consumer Reports. If you're buying or selling a car, what's the best way to do it? I'm talking about used cars these days. You have so many options, right? You can do it online. You can go to CarMax. You can sell it to a dealer. You can sell it to your uncle. Steve, when's the last time you bought or sold a used car? And did you do that as part of a new car transaction with a new car dealer, or how did that go? Last time I bought a used car.
I bought a used car from friends from a few years ago.
Oh, from friends?
Yeah.
Yeah. I bought one from a car dealer. And it turned out to be fine. You know, nothing wrong with that. And you always know they're making a little bit of money on that, but I think they should, so I don't mind that either.
Do you mind if I jump in here a little bit?
Go ahead, Steve.
We're getting tape delay. They wouldn't allow it to be broadcast live, but here is Sarah Huckabee Sanders talking about the email release today.
I'm simply referring you to people that can answer that question, Matthew. Alex.
Sarah, in January, the president said that nobody in his campaign had been in touch with the Russians, and the White House stood by that statement. Was the president misled, or was he not truthful?
Once again, to repeat myself, I'm going to refer you to the outside counsel, and I don't have anything else to add.
Sarah, can we ask you, why were you interested in answering the questions yesterday, and why the president is not answering the questions himself? Either for you or directly today.
The president.
What changed between yesterday and today?
Look, the president gave a statement on the matter, which I read to you, and like I've said, I don't have anything else to add beyond that.
Is the president still of a mind that he would like the investigation under special counsel and the committees on Capitol Hill to work as expeditiously as possible, and he wants to cooperate and wants his family members and his top aides here at the White House to cooperate?
Absolutely. That's never changed since day one. We'd love to get this matter closed and focus on the big priorities of the American people.
So by not answering questions directly himself or through you, is that in his mind expediting investigation, or is it blocking?
I'm not going to get into the back and forth on that. Maggie.
Sarah, when the White House says there was no collusion, what does the White House mean? What's the definition of collusion?
Again, I've said all that we're going to say on that matter, and anything further, you guys are going to have to reach out to outside counsel, April.
Sarah, the words collusion have been used. Other words have been used, obstruction of justice. They're saying now that's not even half of it. It could be treason or perjury. What does the White House have to say? There are new terms brought into this, new serious, more serious terms.
product is. I don't know how many times we'll have to address this.
I'm not asking about Don Jr. I'm asking about these words being brought into this equation that you want, this White House wants this whole investigation to be gone. The new words now brought in.
I think those new words are ridiculous. Zeke.
Thanks, sir. Two questions for you. First, asking specifically about actions taken by White House staff in the last 72 hours.
I'm sorry, White House what?
By White House staff recently, so something that should not require you deferring to the special counsel. Can you talk about who inside the White House has been involved in your response on this? Has the president been kept in the loop, the chief of staff, others in the administration? Are you looking into potential communications by others on the White House staff in regards to this matter or similar matters?
All of the appropriate parties have been part of that conversation and part of that discussion.
Right, sorry, and the second question, Jared Kushner has apparently forwarded this same email. Is he still, is his security clearance still valid right now?
As always, we've never discussed the security clearance of
and
any
sorry, just one more. Yesterday, you said you checked back to us on the status of how the president views the U.S.-Russia relationship. So you today update us, is Russia a friend or foe?
I haven't had a chance to have that direct conversation. I've been a little preoccupied with other things, Major. But I certainly will check on that, Zeke.
Policy question on Afghanistan, that's something that I'm about to say. So
there you go, John Williams. That's a little bit of what we're hearing. It's unusual. It's highly unusual in that this isn't live. This is tape delay. Apparently, it's my understanding that the White House didn't allow for a live broadcast of it. There are not video pictures of it on TV. I'm watching CNN in a monitor, and they've got a still as they listen to the audio only of Sarah Huckabee Sanders.
I'm sorry, Steve. So that's the White House releasing, if you will. What you were listening to now was the live release.
It was a tape delayed. Yeah. It was a tape delayed release.
But our first chance to hear that.
Yes, absolutely.
Why? What's the value then if they're going to release it in its entirety? What's the point in tape delaying it?
You know, I'd have to defer to some reporters there. But my first thought would be that it's a little less enticing to carry live. You know, a network might carry it live if
sure.
it's available live.
Well,
if
the
it's
Sean
not,
Spicer show has been must-see TV.
Right, and so if it's not, they might get a little less coverage that way.
Yeah, right. Well, that's a fascinating exchange there, and I think everybody gets frustrated when you hear something like that. Time and again, she says, I'm not going to answer that. Is it treason or perjury? Blah, blah, blah. You know what she's going to say, and that is, I'm not going to answer that. Defer to outside counsel. But I think it's also incumbent upon the reporters to ask those questions.
Yes.
And so maybe that's another reason not to broadcast it live, although I found it quite compelling and telling. But that's where the head of the press and the people are, and that's the way the White House is handling it. That's all fair game, but I don't think they're wrong to ask those questions.
No, and you know, in fact, one question in the follow-up was, you told us yesterday you would get an answer to this today. What is the answer? And she said, I don't have it. You know, so I think there's value in, you know, the questions often are dodged by politicians or others saying, I'll look into that. There was one recently, it doesn't matter who it was, but they said a couple days later, they said, hey, you said you were going to look into it. He said, I did. I didn't say I was going to tell you. So.
Well, so there they are asking questions that they don't want to answer or don't have the answers to.
Thinking big thoughts. So you don't have to.
Thank you, Steve.
Here's John Williams.
There's some big thoughts there, paying attention. I'm fascinated by the idea that the markets pay attention to certain words in the news, and when the market drops 100 points in an instant, it wasn't because of the fundamentals per se, and it wasn't even because of what the president or his son did. It was because of what, Steve Bertrand?
It was because of computer headline reading algorithms.
So what were the words in those headlines that caused the market to react?
Head for the cliffs. I don't know.
Junior,
I would imagine Trump email. I don't know.
Right. Trump email, Junior, toxic, all bad.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because we talk a lot about humans being replaced, and not that stock analysts are endangered at all, but in many cases, you know, computers are doing that job now too.
Yeah, but this is an instance where the computers were
kind of wrong.
Completely. Right, but I mean, right. If this administration falls apart, then does the United States suffer, and do the markets react accordingly? Quite possibly, yes. although it wouldn't fall into Democrat hands. It would fall into more sane Republican hands.
Well, I think it would just be, no, I mean,
it would be bad for markets.
It'd be the uncertainty of it all, the turmoil of it all.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, there are day traders, right, or moment-by-moment traders who would trade on this sort of news and made a lot of money today.
Huh. Yeah, you mean somebody saw that coming, jumped out on that?
Bought it at the bottom.
Wow.
That's what I like to pretend I do.
Yeah, right.
Pretend.
So I'm interested, too, though, when Sarah Huckabee was, I'm sorry, Steve, her three-word name is
Sarah Huckabee Sanders.
So, and we always say Huckabee Sanders, or do we say Sanders?
You can say whatever you'd like.
I'm going to say Sarah Huckabee Sanders.
Okay.
So when she was not answering questions, which is her right, she's speaking for the president didn't want to complicate things any further, so she keeps dismissing questions. But the media was just pummeling her with questions about the Donald Trump Jr. email dump. And so then somebody asked, was the president not telling the truth, or was he misled? When he previously said we had nobody in my team had any connections with the Russians.
Right.
Here's his son saying, I took a meeting on that pretext. So was the president not telling the truth, or was he misled? And by the way, you know what happens when you mislead the president or vice president? You're gone. So which was it? Boy, that's a rock and a hard place question. And she demurred. She said, we're not going to answer that.
Right, because if she did answer it, that's an answer that could really come back to haunt them.
There's no good answer to that question, and yet that's the question. That is the question right there. Was the president not telling the truth, or was he misled? He does not cotton either of those well.
You know, I was thinking of that before this morning. You know, people keep saying, well, they should just get it all out there. You know, they should just release it all, every meeting, every appointment, just put it out there. Who would do that? Would you do that?
Well,
you know, if you
depends on what the it is.
Well,
I guess.
If you think, you know, that they're looking at things, and you have embarrassing meetings or something
yeah,
like that,
right?
You know, it's like, well, I'm not going to offer it. We'll see if they find it.
Except that the New York Times had that. That's why I was shocked that Donald Trump Jr. was so, you know, transparent, to use his father's word, about it, because I wouldn't have volunteered that. I wouldn't lie about it, but I sure wouldn't volunteer that.
Volunteer the emails?
Yeah.
I want to say again, the New York...
I know.
We've seen this. This is what happens. When someone releases something like this, they're trying to get ahead of the curve. The New York Times was about to publish this email, and they said within minutes that they were going to do that. And so Donald Trump Jr. releases it and says he's being transparent when... The reporting is really he was minutes ahead of it being reported about him.
Yeah, right. And then his defense becomes, there was nothing there. There was no there. I fail.
There's there here.
Well, the there is that you took the meeting. I know it was inconsequential, but that is beside my point. And if I were him, I would have edited that last sentence, because that's such a weak defense. It almost hurts you. There was nothing there. Well, are you kidding me?
It wasn't even that he took the meeting. It was that the email said the Russian government, who was working to elect your dad.
Yeah.
Not in those words, but essentially in almost those words.
And did he back away? Did he show caution? He said, if that's what it is, I love it. Now, this is the president's son. It's not the president. Doesn't mean he's immune from potential charges, but it's not the president. Did the president know about this exchange? That's why you have a special investigator. It's 2:16. This is WGN. We're in the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue. I'm John Williams. The Tribune's editorial today, they're booing at Wrigley, but all is well. Sure caught my eye. Did it catch yours? Because we've all been so, if not just disappointed, kind of surprised, almost shocked at how very average the Cubs have been the first half of the season. More than half now, right? And so they wrote that there was a third type of booing that you fans can lay out on the field at a baseball game, that we've detected at Wrigley Field, where the world champion Cubs are playing decidedly mediocre ball. John Lester gave up a ridiculous 10 runs in the top of the first inning. Out came the boos, but delivered in unhurried fashion. They were mild in tone, slightly forgiving, almost ironic, as if to say, you Cubs stink, but really, it's all because you won the freaking World Series last year for the first time since 1908, and we're still basking in that glory. What a nuanced boo you all were laying out. on the field the other day. Our Mark Carman was at that game. I asked him to join us and talk a little bit about what happened and what's going to happen next. Hey, Mark, how are you?
John, I'm great. Thanks for having me. I was once a day trader. Very tough job. Good to be with you today, not doing that.
You are not a day trader.
I was. I was.
You were not.
But I was. I was terrible. Down $100, down $200, down $500, down $700. Oh, now it's coming back. I'm up 10 cents. I'll take it. $700 risk for a 10-cent win. That's not how you make money trading, John. Just to give a little lesson here on WGN. Apologize. I know that's not why you called.
But day traders don't risk $700. They risk $70,000. Were you trading for somebody or with your own money?
Oh, no, I was trading for somebody, and I was put on a very limited amount of risk.
And so how long did you do that?
Oh, it probably lasted a year. It was in conjunction with some play-by-play.
Can you hold on for just a second?
Sure.
Sure. Do you believe a word of what he's saying right now? I think he's pulling my leg, and I'm just falling into it like it's a real-life conversation. All right, let's go back to Mark Carman, already in progress.
Trading.
Say that again?
You can look it up. Kirshner Trading, Austin, Texas.
Right,
it happened.
Fine.
I didn't inspire many people in the office, I can tell you that.
It's funny because I think there's a certain symmetry between sports analysis and the stock market. It's a numbers game. It's a little gut. Nate Silver, you know, went from sports to politics. There's some similarities there with 538. I would think if you'd be good at one, you'd be good at the other. You're clearly good at sports. Maybe you should go back to day trading.
You never know what the future holds, but I don't think that will be my future, John. It was I learned quickly that that is not my body makeup, if you will.
You know, before we got into this business, talk radio, I was approached by a firm to be, I was actually starting out in my career as talk radio, and a brokerage house asked me to train to be a stock broker for them. So I took some classes and did some meetings and that sort of thing. And then I decided not to go there for two reasons. Do you want to know what they are?
Yes. I do.
Well, one was, I thought I was going to be like doing numbers and helping people and analysis and get this stock and it'll go up. And I discovered it was sales. No, they're like, no, we're going to get 100,000 units of AT&T. You're going to need to get on the phone and sell them to people as investment vehicles. And I thought, oh, I don't want to do that. The other thing was that they said, you have to take a test called the Series 7. If you fail the Series 7, you don't get a second take. But to take the Series 7, you have to quit your job and do nothing but study for it. So it was a roll of the dice. It was an all or nothing. I said, I'm not going to do that because I didn't think I was not a good test taker.
I passed the Series 7. It's a five-hour test, two parts of the day. And, John, when I passed a 74, you needed a 70 to pass, I started emotionally tearing up the whole thing, and the testing grader person looked at me like, are you going to cry? Yes, I am. Do you understand that the chance of me passing this test right now is like 3%, and I did it? I've earned these tears.
Totally. I mean, that was me, and I would have been the guy crying because they would have been 69, and then I would have used my well-honed skills of persuasion and talk radio to say, well, how about that? And they would have said, no, you don't pass. You don't have a job now. I wasn't going to do that.
Yeah. Well, I get it. Believe me, that's a scary world over there.
Talk about the Cubs. Were you at that game, and what was the booing like in this, you know, kind of as important as one game in the front half of a mediocre season can be? That was an important game, wasn't it?
It was. I mean, we're at the point now where they all are. I mean, you're 5.5 games back. If this was the Cubs pre-winning the World Series and the Brewers were actually the Cardinals of, say, you know, 3 years ago, everyone would think the season's over right now. So the games are important. And as far as the booing, look, man, you give up 10 runs in the first inning, you are going to get booed. Should Cub fans be booing John Lester, who was enormous all season long last year and was especially enormous in Game 7 coming out of the bullpen and shouldn't have been taken out for Aroldis Chapman and would have closed out the game if Joe Maddon hadn't lost his senses? No, you shouldn't boo John Lester, but it's not surprising that you have 10 in the first, you're going to get booed. And it's true, they did build. It was kind of like, well, we sort of have to boo. now were actually really mad after the Grand Slam, and you're still out there and still giving up home runs as, who was it, McCutcheon hit the final solo shot. So, Madden should have had him out of there
before
he did.
But, so then were those boos essentially directed at Madden? Or maybe they're not that conscious, these boos. They're just boos. They're just, I'm angry, I'm booing. But I'm not a fan of booing my own team, and I'm not a fan of booing John Lester.
I agree, and it never helps, right?
Well, that's it. That's it. You really, why are you booing? Because that's my team and I want them to play well. How does booing help? I know you paid $48.50 to park, but still, whose side are you on this? Is the where, you know, how I feel about that.
Yeah, I'm totally with you. The whole idea that I paid my money, I'm allowed to do whatever I want to do. Listen, that's true, but no one put a gun to your head and said you have to buy these tickets. Go there, root for the team. If you want to protest, if you're upset, a bold move would have been walking out at 10-0 in the first. I didn't see anybody leaving. The place was crowded. I mean, the whole way through, and people just kind of settled in. And I was trying to uplift the fans, John, just for the record.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, in the third inning, listen, if you take out the first inning, we're only down 2-1.
Well, it is amazing, isn't it? I mentioned this yesterday. At that rate, we should have lost 90-0. But we didn't now, did we? So how
exactly
is it
right.
How is it that we can be so – granted, it's one pitcher. But it's amazing that they can be that good, say. I mean, Lester's no schlub. He was off. But they're hitting him to the tune of 10 runs in one inning. And then they essentially are shut out for the rest of the game. How does that happen? How can a team be that good and then that bad, or vice versa?
Right. I mean, that's just the crazy game of baseball. You never know what's going to happen. I was holding out hope, and if you take out the first inning, they only lost 4-3. You're right there, John.
And by the way, down 4-3, I like our chances. We can win that game. So really,
absolutely,
it could have gone either way.
And like one more thing on the booing real quick. Like Kyle Schwarber's been brutal all season long. He still gets worshipped out there. That was just an aberration.
But he had a good game. But he had a good game that day.
Sure. But they haven't really booed him when he hasn't. And he's still beloved.
Oh, so wait a minute. Now you're arguing that if we're going to boo the team or Lester, we need to boo Schwarber too?
If you want to boo, I don't think they should boo Schwarber, the guy who won you a World Series. I don't think they should boo anyone on this team. If you had somebody who was new, who wasn't trying,
that's it.
Then, Cub fans, when Alex Gonzalez came back as a member of the Toronto Blue Jays, the man who booted the routine ground ball that would have gotten you to the World Series in 2003, when he came back and had his first at bat, they cheered him. That would have been the time to boo. I would have been okay with that.
Okay, so Mark Carmen's on the phone. I got a couple questions for you about, is it possible, Mark, answer this, that as odd as it is that we've been this mediocre or bad for the first half, isn't it also equally possible, equally odd, but we could recapture our mojo from last year? Does the All-Star break offer us any sort of hope for a pivot in a minute on WGN? We're wrapping up with Mark Carmen. Carm, of course, does sports on WGN Radio. You hear him on The Beat on weekends and on this show once in a while. And I got a question or two about sports. We were talking about the editorial in the Trib today. They're booing at Wrigley, but all is well. People still basking in the glory, but so frustrated. They have this odd kind of passive boo for the last game of the first half. By the way, Carm, a couple of texts. John, if a family financially can only go to one game a year, you know how this is going to go. And that was the game. They have every right to boo. Carm, you were sort of dismissing that logic a moment ago, right?
And then, I'm not saying that they don't have the right to do it. But, okay, family of four. Is that really what you want to teach your kids? Things don't go your way. Boo. I don't think it's a great lesson. That's just my own personal take on it. You certainly can do whatever you want. They're not going to throw you into prison.
Hey, John, my son and I were at a Cubs-Mets game. After the second grand slam of the inning, the fans booed. They threw stuff on the field. We expected Ron Santo to fall out of the booth. Yes, we were entitled to boo. This is a time, and there is a time and a place for it. What do you think of the second half? Is it possible that we could pivot and, find whatever magic we had last year?
It's possible, but I am not going to sit here and be super optimistic about it. The rotation is just not very good right now. Lester has been their best pitcher, and he hasn't been fantastic. He's been better than okay, but that's about it. And then Arrieta is down, and Lackey's on the DL, and Hendricks is coming off the DL, and Jason Hamill's in Kansas City, and Eddie Butler should be in AAA. I could keep going here. there's a reason they only have one All-Star who wasn't on the team last year. They could turn it around, and I think the offense has a greater capability of flipping because there is more talent there that hasn't performed.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you got to pitch, and unless they're super aggressive in bringing in a starter, it's asking for a real, real, real big flip from some aging guys, too.
So do we make the playoffs?
I don't know. I'd put it at, let's call it a 50-50. That's what I would say.
I don't believe in 50-50s. 50-50s tells me nothing.
Yeah, if I had to bet my life on whether the Cubs make the playoffs or not, I'd say no.
There you are. You don't have to bet your life, by the way, but that's kind of
what
I need.
All
right, yeah, because like if for instance, if they make the playoffs, we're not going to come and get you. You did not just bet your life. But I wanted to know which side of 50 you're on, and you're on the downside of 50. You don't think, just by a teeny bit, that they're going to make the playoffs this year. Wow. All right. Well, look at the Giants. They won it every other year for 6 years. I mean, you know, there's that sort of World Series hangover. Maybe we'll win it next year.
I'd love to win it next year. I'd sign up for it right now. I'd give up this year. And I really, really, really hope I'm wrong. I hope I am.
All right, bud. I'll talk to you later. Thanks, Mark.
Okay, John.
In passing, I asked you earlier in the show, when's the last time you bought or sold a car?
Right.
A used car, obviously, if you're selling it, and maybe buying one, too. I bought one from a dealer. I bought one from a guy I didn't know. I haven't done that in a while.
We bought a convertible Bug from a couple that went to Italy with us.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Okay, but that helped because you had some relationship with these people then. You knew them, you trusted them, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm in the business of selling my car, and there's two things. One is, as a seller, I'm not sure what to price it at. I looked it up in Kelley Blue Book. Was saddened to see a number smaller than I thought. I thought, this car's got better chops than that.
It says in the front page, the numbers are never bigger than you think.
I felt bad for my car. It hurt its feelings. But then there's the whole thing about, so this is the quandary of the seller. It's like, now, who do I trust to meet in a parking lot? Or what's the best way for me to get the best price? And then as a buyer, you've got all those things in reverse, right? Who do you trust? Is this guy really representing the vehicle as is, et cetera, et cetera? We reached out to somebody who knows a little bit about this. Mike Quincy, automotive specialist for Consumer Reports, joins us on WGN. Hi, Mike. Thanks for taking our call. How are you?
Good afternoon, guys. How are you guys doing today?
We're doing well. So let's start from the buyer's perspective. What are the things that a seller, because I'm the seller. What are the
I
things?
I want to hear more about that old Bug, though. I think that's more interesting than anything I've been driving lately.
Doesn't that sound like
I'm
fun?
Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah,
let me tell you, this weekend it was fun.
Yeah, as long as it was working. You know, you say, well, it was fine when I had it, Lois. I don't know why it broke down on you. They always say you're buying somebody else's problems. Give me some tips generally, let's say. What should buyers and sellers be aware of?
Well, I think you kind of hit on it when you started the segment, and that's you really need to know what your car is worth. I mean, if you're going to be selling your car, it's good to have an idea of its value. But this is, I guess, I think this is common knowledge, but it's probably maybe it isn't. But you're always going to get more if you sell the car yourself as opposed to trading it in on a new car. And that's kind of, you know, that's just kind of the way the business works. The dealer is going to give you more of a wholesale price, whereas if you sell yourself, you're going to try to get something closer to the retail price. But you're not going to have anyone interested if your car, you know, looked like it's lived through a war. So one of the first tips you can do when you go to sell your car is clean it up, get it detailed, and make it look super presentable.
What do you think of places like CarMax? You know, I mean, because if the difference is $3,000 versus $3,400, I don't know that that's the difference. But I think some people would say for $400, I'll let them, I'll take the convenience and the check. What do you make of places like that?
No, I can totally see the appeal. In fact, you know, one of the number one questions that I get working here at Consumer Reports is, what do you do with all the test cars when you're done with them? And the short answer is that where we sell them to the people working for Consumer Reports, first of all, and if we can't get a buyer within that 400 or 500 pool of people, then we'll either trade it in on another test car. But we have brought a bunch of cars to CarMax, believe it or not, and we've gotten decent pricing for it. So they're a major retailer, nationwide retailer, so they might have more flexibility to look at your car and give you top dollar for it, as opposed to maybe the smaller, like, mom-and-pop shops. So I would definitely give CarMax a try. At least get an assessment of what you think that they will give you.
What do you make of Kelley Blue Book?
Yeah, you know, they're one of many pricing information, just sources for information, whether you go Kelley Blue Book, whether you go Edmunds, there's all kinds of numbers. But it's all going to depend really on where you live. For example, if you live, let's say, in California. I just got back from a trip from California vacation, and boy, you can't walk a block without seeing a Toyota Prius. So obviously Priuses are really popular out in California, whereas in the middle of Minnesota, they might not be as popular. Selling an SUV in Minnesota might be easier than in California. So it depends on where you're selling your car. It depends on how many miles are on your car. It used to be that if a car was like 100,000 miles, people would say, "Oh my gosh, that's red flags and it's terrible." But these days, cars can go 200,000 or 300,000 miles. So 100,000 miles might not be as bad as you think it is. And like I said before, it really depends on the condition. Is the car been well kept? Do you have lots of receipts to show oil changes? Mm-hmm. If the car has had a timing belt, have you proof that was done? So the more receipts that you have to prove to the buyer, potential buyer, that you've been taking care of it, the better.
You know, my car, it takes a while to turn over sometimes, but once the car's warm, then that's not a problem. If I were to sell you the car, I'd pull up and you'd say, "Well, let me drive it." And I'd say, "Okay, here's the keys," and you start it up and it'd start right up. But the next day when you went to start it, you'd hit the button and it would go, it would work for a while, and you'd say, "Something's wrong there. I think something's wrong there, but I'm not exactly sure what it is, and it's nothing I felt compelled to get fixed." Now, when I go to sell you that car, what's the ethic or the law on my having to share with you that information?
Well, it's really buyer beware. I mean, it depends on how well you sleep at night. That's a tough question. I mean, from an ethical standpoint, I think you should disclose absolutely everything that's wrong with the car. Will you scare away from buyers? You might. I think you should. I'm sure that a lot of people will not. Whereas if you buy a used car and you're going to a major retailer, you're going to a big car dealership that has an enormous lot, you might have some recourse as opposed to a private sale.
Yeah.
If I buy the car from you, you're certainly under no obligation to help me fix it. You're like, "Dude, I gave you the car, you gave me the check, we're done. Don't bother me anymore." But the car dealer, they have a social reputation. They have something to withhold, and they might say, "Okay, listen, bring it in. Let's see what we can do for you." If you go through a retailer, a major retailer, you might also get a bit of a warranty, as opposed to the private sale. Obviously, you're not going to be offering any kind of a warranty.
Are there some makes and models that retain their value better than others on the used car market?
I think, when you put it in kind of a Consumer Reports perspective, and we do a lot of work studying automotive reliability, and the models that tend to be most reliable as new cars, no surprise, yeah, tend to be most reliable as used cars. So, I mean, Hondas, Toyotas, Subarus, Mazdas, those are cars that are usually the top of our reliability ratings, and so those cars will probably tend to bring in,
sure,
a higher premium. But here's a curveball. One car that does not have good reliability but retains its value like crazy, a Jeep Wrangler. Why? Because they're so wildly popular.
Huh. I thought you were going to say Corvette too, but I get the point. What about Craigslist and online versus newspaper versus, I don't know, I mean, would you have any suggestions or advice along those various means of selling the car per se?
I think anytime you use these kind of classified outlets, it can be a real crapshoot. I mean, you don't know what kind of, if you're advertising your car. I mean, you said before, you know, why don't you meet in a big public place where there's lots of people surrounding you? You want to have your own personal security in mind. You might not want to have somebody come to your house. And that's, you know, that's another reason why some people go to CarMax or they go to the big car dealer, because they might feel safe about that. I mean, there's risk involved in anything. I mean, whenever you're buying a used car, and certainly if you're like me and you like, you know, classic cars, you're hoping to find that, you know, they call it a barn find. You're hoping to find that 1965 Mustang that really has been driven by a little old lady only to church every Sunday. So you're hoping to find kind of that needle in a haystack. You're hoping to find a rare car that you covet, and maybe the current owner doesn't even know it's a valuable or a rare car. But those are few and far between. And obviously, I think, you know, starting off this radio interview, you're probably not thinking about classic cars. You're thinking about day-to-day cars.
One last thing. I'm going to visit with you again another day, but you haven't driven the Tesla, have you?
Oh, sure. Driven all of them except the brand new one, which I don't think many people have driven. But, yeah, driven the Tesla Model S and the Model X. And oh, sure, everybody wants to talk about Tesla.
Yeah, well, I was wondering if you drove the 3 yet, but not yet, huh?
No, not yet. That just went into production, I believe, like last Friday or something like that. I mean, from a technical standpoint, the company is very impressive. From a financial standpoint, I think they're kind of dubious. They don't really make a lot of money, if any, on the cars that they sell. And certainly, this is not an investment show, or at least I hope I'm not going to be asked to be quoting investments. But you know, just looking at how the cars perform on the road, they're most impressive, but they are very expensive.
Yeah, no kidding. I thought they were rolling out in July. I thought that we were going to be able to buy those things this month.
Well, they promised production on last Friday, and I believe that they kicked off production. But when those cars are going to actually be in people's hands, I don't know.
Yeah, we'll talk again. Hey, listen, thanks for your help and thoughts on this. We'll visit down the road. Mike Quincy, thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
WGN, we're in a very unfortunate loop these days. It seems just as my show is ending, or during my show, some other news erupts about the White House. And then when Ro Khan comes in, all of us hoping for peace and calm, I feel bad for Kevin and Violetta and the rest of you guys, because then he goes anew. Kev, it's tough for you guys, I know.
We're here for him either way, John.
It's true.
We're a team. It's a team effort.
It's true.
So
it's
if somebody needs to be picked up by another one, it's what we do. It's what we do for each other, John.
Dysfunctional family, but yes. I think but it works. But it works for you guys.
It works, yeah.
I guarantee you he's going to go off on this Donald Trump Jr. email thing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, we're ready for it. Maybe it's therapeutic for Ro. I think he needs to get off his chest. So we're here to listen, John, and be a family and a friend to him.
Yeah, kind of talk him down.
Yeah. Talk him down.
You wanted a development on the story?
Yeah, anything new?
Yeah, Stephen Colbert tweets, I know these Donald Trump Jr. emails look bad, but they also sound bad and are bad.
So there's that. So it's not just the appearance. They are, in fact, bad. Well, boy, there's a sentence in there that is the most damning of them all, and that's where he... but you know, and I guess in their defense, I love the president's statement on this. He said, I applaud his transparency. Okay, you got that going for you. And I guess that's better than denying it and it coming out. And the New York Times is about to divulge it. I wonder if you're, in fact, being transparent when it's under those circumstances. But the most damning sentence of them all was written not by Donald Trump Jr., but by this Rob Goldstone guy to whom the president's son responded. And he said, he says, the Crown Prosecutor of Russia met with his father, Aris, this morning, and in their meeting offered to provide the Trump campaign with some official documents and information that would incriminate Hillary and her dealings with Russia and would be very useful to your father. Where's the sentence I'm looking for? Here it is, I think. This is, excuse me, obviously very high-level and sensitive information, but is part of Russia and its government support for Mr. Trump. Okay, now this is by Rob Goldstone. That's not by the president of Russia. That's not by the Russian ambassador. His name isn't Sergei anybody. His name is Rob Goldstone. He did PR for Michael Jackson and James Taylor concerts. So he's just kind of an odd guy who they met through the beauty pageant business, and now he's reaching out to them saying, hey, I know a guy. I got a guy. And he's got the goods on Hillary and the Russians. So while that sentence looks like a hell of a thing, it's from some hack, whatever. But then what makes it worse is Don Jr. responds by saying, seems like we have some time. And if that's what you say, I love it, especially later in the summer, i.e. closer to November. So that's what Ro's probably going to spend some time talking to you about. You know the story that everybody's talking about today? Steve Cochran mentioned this to Bill and Wendy when they were doing Crosstalk, and it's that days-old story now of the kid who woke up at the campsite, heard a crunching sound, his head was in a bear's mouth.
Yeah, I saw the tweet for that. I haven't heard the rest of the story.
Well, he survived. Okay? Well, both he and the bear are with us today. Can I just call BS on that? I don't believe that story. I'm sorry. If you hear a crunching sound and it's your head in a bear's mouth and there are no Captain Crunch in the tent.
Right. The crunching sound would be your skull getting crushed,
then
right?
You aren't there to tweet about it the next day. That's not a true story, or it's not as being presented. I don't want to impugn the integrity of a nice little boy who went out on a camping trip and seemed to survive. Happy about that. But I do not believe that story.
You're calling it fake news.
I'm calling it fake news. Okay. I'm calling it the worst kind, fake bear news.
Bear down.
Okay, Rose in the house. Team Khan is in the studio. Anna's here. Rose here. Hi, kids.
Hi, John.
Hello, John.
Hello.
I'm fascinated by your theory that
I am too.
that the bear attack story might be hoaxy.
We were talking about it yesterday, and I was like, how does that happen?
It's
and
too
not-
good a story to be true. It's too good a story to be true. I mean, I love it. I'll tell it to my friends. I don't believe a word of it.
All right. Is there more backing to this might be a hoax kind of thing, or is this something you
it's just
put
my
together?
Own skepticism these days. I don't believe or trust anything.
Oh, man. Mm-hmm. It's very 1960s. Done. You don't trust anybody over the age of 35, do you?
It's trickled down, this sort of seeping, distrust of authorities and news and politicians. Mm-hmm. And now a boy in the woods attacked by a bear. And I'm calling BS on him, but I am.
Well, if it were Donald Trump Jr., I would guess that it would not be true. But
there would be several statements varying accounts of it.
Right. And
as we learned about more.
Sarah Huckabee Sanders, I'm going to have to refer all of these questions to the outside medical staff. And
I have a brief statement that's seven words.
And the president stands by you. I love when the president applauds Donald Trump Jr.'s transparency.
Yeah.
Who denied ever having any kind of contact with any Russian ever in his life.
I don't know that that's being transparent when minutes before the New York Times tells on you, you tell on yourself.
That's right.
I mean, he's being transparent with a gun to his head.
That's true. They had already approached him about the email contents indicating they had them, and then he released them.
By the way,
them.
Is it a crime if it's sort of like if you reach into the cookie jar and there's no cookies there. This was the editorial cartoon in the Tribune today. And said, I didn't do anything wrong. I wasn't stealing cookies. There's no cookies to steal.
Yeah. He didn't know that, though. The problem is he was intending to get information and then was annoyed when he didn't get it.
Yeah.
And but I don't know that that's a crime. People are calling it treason. Is that treason?
I think it's treason's a crime. I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's the big T.
It's not. It actually doesn't. Treason isn't during a time of war. Espionage is a would be a chargeable crime, but that's not even close. But I think we'll talk to Brett Baer from the Fox News Channel coming up in this hour about this. But I can't. Every day I get up and I'm like, how is this?
Here we go
what
again.
Happened to my America?
I vowed we weren't going to get into this conversation.
Every day.
So I'm just going to talk about puppy. Talk about bears.
Oh, the bears.
The bears.
The Chicago Bears are going to really be bad. I don't know what to do about that.
Let's not talk about Chicago Bears just yet.
All right. Okay.
Have a good show, Ro.